If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hi, I'm Megan Segura.
And I'm Eric J. Mack.
And this is The Daily Dish, Bravo's official podcast.
We know you guys love our behind-the-scenes producer interviews. Well, I have a great one for you. I spoke to Matt Reichman, Vice President of Current Production at Bravo, who works on shows like Below Deck Sailing Yacht, which if you haven't watched, season 2 just premiered and it is epic, plus Top Chef and so many more. He talked about his history in production, how he got his start on shows like MTV's Next, Dismissed, Date My Mom, and how his love of shows like Project Runway eventually led him to work at Bravo. Plus, he revealed what it's like to work with people like Tom Colicchio and Captain Lee, and which Bravo show he secretly wishes he worked on. Here's that interview. So Matt Reichman, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for taking the time to do this and to talk to me and all the Bravo super fans out there.
I am thrilled to be here.
So I want to start with the easy thing. What is your title at Bravo?
Title at Bravo is Vice President of Current Production. And what that means is I am in charge of a number of different series for Bravo.
And what do you do for those shows?
What I do is, it's a bit of a jack of all trades. You know, there is, once a series, once Bravo and NBC Universal has decided that we're excited about a show and it's gone through the development process, that typically gets handed over to somebody in the current team who then is, you know, in some ways responsible for managing that investment. And what that means is taking the gem of the idea that has been developed and making sure that the producers who are bringing us this show, this product, my job is to make sure that we are, you know, getting what we paid for and getting the best possible version of that, you know? So, that checks a lot of different boxes, you know, just managing the investment.
Great. I want to know, because so many people have really responded to these interviews that we do with our Bravo execs. Believe it or not, people think you have the coolest job. And I think that a lot of people would be curious to know how you got your start. What was the journey that led you here?
Well, it's a great job. It's, you know, through this job, I have seen the world, you know, three or four times over. You know, I'm really fortunate to get to work on some projects that, you know, allow me to go see some amazing things and see and witness, you know, very talented people doing those amazing things and working with them. You know, it didn't always start there. You know, everybody's path's a little different. My beginnings were, you know, out of college, I packed up my Toyota Camry and I drove out to LA, not knowing many people. When I got to Los Angeles, wanting to sort of break into the industry, the unscripted space was really starting to, you know, take foothold in the industry. It was very niche for a while, and I kind of came to LA right in, like, the, we'll call it the golden era of unscripted in a lot of ways, where, every idea was fresh and new. You know, very, very little had been produced. And, you know, you had like the Survivors and the Temptation Islands and the Real World and the Road Rules and, you know, some of those big shows that are still amazing and going today. But this really was a time when that industry was exploding, and that's where a lot of the jobs were. And it was really fun. It was a lot of young people working in, you know, breaking into the industry. It was a growing field. It was very like, you know, startup in a lot of ways. And I, you know, within the unscripted space, I landed at MTV and I got to work on such amazing high profile shows as, you know, Date My Mom, Next, Dismissed, all those great sort of after school dating shows that were really fun and entertaining.
I love that you describe it that way. And I wonder if at MTV you guys actually did talk about it that way, because I certainly, that was my experience. I would get home from school and I would absolutely watch those shows. I remember The Next Bus quite well. So I love that.
If the walls could talk in The Next Bus. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how safe for work some of this is could be, but The Next Bus was an amazing experience. You know, it was like guerrilla producing. There was, you know, there were very little rules, and there were a lot of people that, you know, were just, everyone was just really fun about it. And this was before social media, but, you know, the ages that we were working with, you know, like it was like, there's like 18 plus, and these were a lot of, you know, college age people that were really fun and just like living their life, you know, unabashedly out loud, you know, not a care in the world. Again, there was no sort of concerns with social media at that point. And this was sort of like their opportunity to like let loose and have fun on a set and be on a TV set. And they just had a lot of fun with it. You know, nobody ever really took it too seriously. There was very little at stake, and the kids were often in on the joke. And that's kind of what I think made it really fun. But yes, there was a lot. My eyes have seen a lot on The Next Bus.
So that was your experience working. And then as, you know, hopefully a fan of reality TV, what were sort of the shows you found yourself drawn to as a viewer?
So that's really interesting because, you know, I was at MTV for quite a few years, sort of being in that world. And again, it was just really fun. Everybody was the same age and we're all just sort of trying to figure out how to produce these shows. And it was really social. It was kind of like being back in college in a lot of ways, but we were getting paid for it, which was fun. You know, had a lot of interesting conversations with my parents about my career path. I got to a point where I was, you know, the shows that I was coming home after work and watching and enjoying also ended up being in the unscripted space. You know, when the shows like Top Chef, Project Runway, Project Greenlight, I got really interested in those shows. And I think what was so amazing about them was it really was about following very talented people, best in their class, and seeing them do remarkable things under very stressful conditions. And it was really inspiring. I'd always sort of fancied myself, you know, a foodie, and I was just really interested in that space. And I got really hooked into the Top Chef of it all. And I was trying to figure out after these questionable conversations with my parents about what I'm doing with my life, you know, I started thinking about what's the next phase of my career. And if I'm going to be, I made all this progress in the unscripted space, why don't I go try and figure out how to work on the shows that I actually really love watching? And it turned out that they were all, most of the shows that I was really invested in were produced by the same production company, a company called Magical Elves. I somehow, you know, weaseled my way over into that company, networked the best I could, and started on a very low level there and climbed the ladder. And eventually I had an opportunity to jump on Top Chef in season 5, the New York season. And that sort of changed everything for me.
Wow. What were some of the other shows you worked on while you were at Magical Elves?
So that at the Elves, you know, they're just a phenomenal production company to work with. And they just have great taste and great sophistication. And, you know, through that process, I was a freelancer, which many people are, you know, as producers in the unscripted space, but I just kept rolling from show to show to show. And I ended up actually working on quite a bit of stuff for Bravo. So Step It Up and Dance, I did a little Project Runway. There was a series called Work of Art, if you could remember that from a few years ago, which was one of my favorite projects ever to work on. So through that process, I just ended up working so much with Bravo and getting to know the Bravo executives and the creative team there. It just so happened that, you know, a position opened at Bravo and an opportunity came my way to join the network side, which was something that was completely unexpected. And, you know, those sorts of things you don't come across very often. So nothing that I ever sort of aspired to do. I always saw myself as kind of, taking the showrunner path and just being that freelancer for life and kind of like joining the circus and living your life on the road forever. I took an opportunity and I joined Bravo about 9 years ago.
What makes someone in that position sort of want to move to the network side?
Well, my experience was seeing the network executives kind of roll into set, and, you know, a few hours after shooting and, you know, have a nice Starbucks and maybe read the New York Times a little bit and sort of look up and say, oh yeah, that looks good. You're doing well there, you know, in Video Village. And when the offer came out, I was like, oh, I can do that job, you know? So that was appealing. I think little did I know what I actually was signing up for. And, you know, I realized very quickly, and we had this meeting, and we still do it. It's changed a little bit over the years, but it's called the EP meeting, and it's for all the internal executive producers on, you know, all the people that do my job in current production. We get together and we sort of talk about things that are happening on our shows. And it's a time where the executives all come together because everybody's a bit siloed, focused very much on their own projects. It's all very time consuming. So whenever there's a chance for the current executives to get together and sort of hear how the other teams are dealing with issues on their series, anything from talent to locations to budgets to calendaring to, you know, you name it, it's really informative and educational to learn what your colleagues are going through. And, you know, you can take those learnings and now you sort of have, oh, this is how you sort of handle that issue and can apply it if that ever comes up on one of your shows. It's a really great meeting. But I'll remember the first time I walked into one of those, you know, when I joined Bravo. And I was, you know, I was used to being, you know, someone whose ideas were usually breaking through on the producer side. And I think that's sort of what got me where I was going. I tended to, you know, the executives were responding a lot to my creative, you know, and when you're producing a show. So I think that's kind of what got me that offer at Bravo. I developed a really strong working relationship, but I learned very quickly that, you know, I was entering a room filled with people that were the smartest people in the room at all times. And it was very humbling very quickly. The level of expertise at Bravo at that time and still today is just tremendous. The amount of brain power that is in some of those meetings and the things that you can learn is just astounding.
Thinking back to, you know, what you kind of thought the job would be in terms of, you know, what you witnessed in Video Village and thinking about your job today, like what's the one thing that you're like, you never could have foreseen how challenging it would be?
That's a really hard question. I feel like I get one of those a week.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's an answer.
I think one of the most amazing parts of the job is that it's never the same. It's never, ever, ever the same. And I've now been doing Top Chef for, I don't even know, 15 years. I'm now in season 18 of it. I've done all the different versions of it, the different franchises. Some have been more successful than others, but it's still, you know, to this day, even this last season we just shot in Portland, which is about to premiere and where it's turned out incredibly well. You know, once we finally cracked how to shoot that show safely in a bubble in the pandemic, which took months and months and months and months and months of planning, like an insane amount of planning to just figure it out. You know, if you think about Top Chef, you're thinking about, you know, challenges where you're feeding hundreds of diners at some point, and it's food and it's restaurants and it's chefs and it's, you know, sharing plates and family stuff. And it's like, none of that can happen in the COVID world. And we had to figure out how to do that. Finally, we're on set, we're about to start doing it. And lo and behold, now we have like protests down, you know, marching through downtown Portland and, you know, getting in the way of our, getting in the way of our set. The political and social unrest in Portland was, you know, during the cycle of the election year, just managing that was absolutely insane. And then on top of it, the worst wildfires, I think, in the history of the state erupted while we were shooting. So I guess to answer your question, there's massive challenges every time we set up cameras, and this year was no different.
Yeah. So, I mean, because of all of your Top Chef experience, and God knows there are so many Top Chef super fans out there, what for you has been your favorite city to film in for the show?
That is like choosing a child, but you know, it's been so many. I mean, I'm so fortunate to have, you know, found myself involved with that show and the places we get to see and the access we get, you know, and the meals that we get to share and, you know, go into, you know, private dinners, you know, at WD-50 or at Liberta Den or with David Chang. I mean, you just, some of the stuff that I've gotten to do is absolutely incredible. But, you know, I think my favorite time ever on set on Top Chef, I had to be in New Orleans. And that's just a special place to me. And it's just a special place in general. But I think just being there, tapping into the life and the verve and the culture and the food and the music. And it just was, I'd have to say that was it.
Have you ever pulled the, I work at Bravo and on Top Chef to get a good reservation?
I think only once, and that was to impress my then girlfriend, who is now my wife, so it worked.
Wow, good for you. I do also always ask, you know, the people that I've interviewed from our Bravo network side, I'm like, how much are you a hit at weddings when you say that you work at Bravo?
It depends on the wedding, and it depends. There's a lot of fun conversations, especially, you know, when I would drop my kid off at school and some of the parents would come over and, you know, wax poetic about Captain Lee and, oh, you get to hang out with Tom Colicchio and Padma and Gale and like all that sort of stuff. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
That's a fun perk. It's not always as glamorous as it seems, but it's fun. It's a fun dinner conversation.
Well, I do have you. I mean, is there anything that fans would be surprised to know about Padma or Tom?
Oh, gosh. Now you're putting me on the spot. Tom Colicchio, the moment that as soon as humanly possible, once we're done filming and we get to judge's table, all he wants to do is throw on a pair of shorts. And so luckily we shoot him from the waist up, which I think is very relatable these days on you know, as people are having... He was way ahead of the curve on Zoom calls, office Zoom calls. So
yeah, that's very funny. I love that.
He looked very dashing in his suit from the waist up.
Okay, a logistical question I have is, when a chef is eliminated, what do you anything to help keep it a secret for any of those diehard sleuth fans out there, or do you let them go back to their lives?
It's interesting because in its heyday, you know, there was like my first season producing Top Chef was in New York City, and there, you know, if you walk into a Whole Foods with a camera crew and 15 people in chef coats and they're running around like it's supermarket sweep.
Yeah.
You're on Top Chef. Like you just,
right.
And we would have like reporters from Eater or Grub Street or whoever stock out the whole, like when they found out we were in a city, they would stock out every Whole Foods in the city, because they knew we're going to Whole Foods. They knew we're going to be there, and they just had to figure out which Whole Foods it was. And we would do like decoy shopping trips at other Whole Foods. We would take, you know, we would split the chefs up. If the chefs get eliminated, if we were doing like an outdoor challenge, I would have the eliminated chefs on set cooking, like as if they were part of the challenge. We would just have them behind the camera line. But to the average, you know, person walking by in the public, they don't know the difference. So they're not, because they're keeping track. Like the sleuths will count. Okay, today at Whole Foods, I saw 15 chefs running around, and it's, you know, these 15 people. There's like this girl with red hair and this guy with tattoos, and here, you know, and there's this Asian chef and blah, 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 blah. And they would figure it out. And then the next day, like 2 days later, they'd be waiting at Whole Foods, and then we'd walk in with 13 chefs, and they'd be like, ooh, there was a double elimination. Oh, those two chefs are gone. They would literally figure it out and post the spoilers online. So we've just had to circumvent all of those things.
Wow.
We no longer shop in chef coats, but I still, you see 15 people running around with cameras chasing them at Whole Foods, you know.
Something's
it's
up.
It's a safe bet. It comes even harder when we're doing like an all-star season. There's no hiding it anymore.
That's amazing.
Luckily they've tamed. You know, they don't track us as viciously anymore.
Well, thank God for that. That is so funny, though. I do want to know, because you've clearly worked on so many shows over the years, and, you know, some are huge hits, some are one-season wonders. I am curious for you, because you have to get invested in these shows that you work on. What was one show that just for you was like, oh, the heartbreak that it didn't work out more?
I think, first of all, I really appreciate the one season wonder reference, and I'm now going to use that. That's really, I like that. That's much better branding than we talk about it internally. But the, I think the one series that I just, you know, I poured my heart into and was really hoping it would have been more successful was a show called Opry Ski, which I then somehow managed to convince everybody to give me a second crack at it on Timber Creek Lodge, which, by the way, if we had those numbers today, I think everyone would have made it a pickup.
Right.
I digress. It was a great show.
You're not bitter. It's fine.
I'm not bitter. But that was a tough one because, you know, that the whole concept of Opry Ski came from another show, which, you know, I've lost a lot of hair on making. It's called Below Deck. And the whole idea of it was, okay, how do we take this really amazing upstairs downstairs dynamic that works so well? And like, where else can we apply it? And what sort of other like luxury experiences can we sort of track the people that make those experiences happen? And it just sort of seemed like a no-brainer. And there was an executive at Bravo who is a diehard skier, a guy named Noah Landau, who had the brilliant idea. And, you know, he was like, why don't we do it this way? And I was blessed with sort of taking the reins of that amazing idea and trying to go and crack it. And, you know, I got to go to Whistler and see it all unfold. And I would make sure that I sent plenty of updates from the chairlift to Noah, you know, on the progress of the shoot and how everything was going. But for, you know, for whatever reason, the show didn't work out. And I know why it didn't ultimately work out. You know, there's just sort of a magic in the Below Deck of it all, you know, the cramming everybody like sardines into one boat where they can't go anywhere. You know, this was just a much harder sort of thing to capture and cover, the Opry Ski of it all. But that's one that I really wish, you know, I wish I could give it some to let me take another crack at it.
Well, so would you say then that you feel like Below Deck is the success that you're most proud of at Bravo?
I think that it is. It's just sort of mind-boggling how that show has taken off.
So when the pitch came in, we had our amazing development team that was led by Christy Dees and another fantastic executive named Jen Levy. Who's now over at Netflix. You know, that team really understood the vision of the show and the potential of it. And it was being brought in and led by a guy named Mark Cronin, who is, and his team over at 51 Minds. And Mark is one of those, Mark is one of the prolific unscripted producers. His shows defined an era of reality programming. And he's a yachtsman himself. I mean, he was just, was so invested in it. And so there's a ton of credit to them for having the idea. And I was really there to support at the beginning and got indoctrinated into the maritime world before taking on the greater role of oversight on the series.
You know, Below Deck, again, when that came in as a pitch, it was one of those ideas that just felt like a no-brainer. You don't hear them very often. It's one of those ideas that you hear it and you're like, yeah, of course, why are we not making that show? It just makes such perfect sense. And it's so obvious that you're kind of like beat yourself, like, how have we not come up with this earlier? Like, how are we now just hearing this idea? And when we started to shoot it, you know, it came in and a lot of the talk about it was, you know, it's like Down Abbey meets The Love Boat on a luxury yacht. And it's all this, you know, you get this that alone is just such a great visual in your mind. And we didn't really know how we were going to tackle it. You know, there's a lot of conversation about, is this going to be, you know, is the show going to be told half and half, like a true upstairs, downstairs, or like Down Abbey? Like, are you really covering the guests for half of the show and the people below deck, the yachties, for half of it? And, you know, it took a long time in the edit to find its voice, but we really worked through it. And it just became very clear that it was all about the stories of the people that are making the vacation happen. And they're going upstairs and putting on their stew face and making amazing cocktails and serving incredible food. And then they walk back downstairs and then they're like making beds and scrubbing toilets. And it's just like the most incredible dynamic to try and watch. And everything that they have at stake to like live this amazing lifestyle, they get to travel around the world, they get to be in the most beautiful places, but yet they're scrubbing toilets. Like, so it's just an amazing thing to just sort of like talk about and think. And I think it really caught a lot of people's attention, but we weren't so confident with it in that first season. There was a lot of conversation of it sort of being, what do we do with the show? Where do we put it? Should we just put it in the summertime, which is not traditionally a prime time slot to launch a show with everybody like doing summer vacation and being outdoors. And it's not huge TV watching time, you know, for a lot of people. And we kind of just placed it there and it just became this rabid word of mouth success that I don't think anybody really saw it coming. And it's just grown and grown and grown and, you know, it's spread out. And now we have multiple boats, multiple franchises. And again, I don't think anybody expected it like that to be the show that has sort of defined the next chapter of Bravo, but it's been amazing to watch.
Yeah. I think personally that part of the magic of Below Deck is Captain Lee. How did you find him?
You sometimes you just know the stud of the sea when you see him. I mean, okay, in all honesty, also, you know, when we were casting that show, again, it's so, I'll back up step for a second, because Below Deck, what I think is also just so amazing about that show is the authenticity of it. And it's really hard to put your finger on how to make that show, because you take a bunch of people that are, you know, really fantastic unscripted reality producers who have worked on huge shows from The Real World to Flavor of Love to, you know, huge shows like house shows, Big Brother, things like that, where you're sort of, you know, documenting it. It very much is a house show. It just takes place on a boat. And we set up cameras everywhere, just kind of like how you do on like a Big Brother. And we're just sort of like tracking it all go down. But what makes Below Deck, I think, really resonate, especially to like a co-viewing audience, and I think what brings the guys in that really enjoy it, you know, they at least this is what they say they love about it. They probably really do love like all like the gossip and the
drama,
soapiness.
Yeah.
But what they do say about it is it's the authenticity of it. And we really honor the process of the boat. It really is a true ocu, and there is a lot of danger and there's a lot of like real life stakes and drama that come from it. You know, if these people really know how to do their job and they are really doing that job. And if you think about it, they're on a boat in the middle of the ocean and if something goes pear-shaped, it's game over. Like this is legit. I'm not going to say it's deadly as catch, but in a lot of ways it's deadly as catch. You know, there is,
right.
You're in the middle of the ocean with a camera crew. And if something goes wrong, if you have somebody who's operating that boat that doesn't know what they are doing, it can go bad really, really quick. And we take it very seriously. And we cast people that really know that job. And I think that that authenticity breaks through. And, you know, we've had a lot of very dangerous moments on that show that, again, you would never imagine it. And that's when like real life happens and the best moments on TV happen, when you're trying to anticipate and you just, there's no way you could have scripted Ashton getting pulled off the boat and almost drowning. You know, like if that camera operator hadn't let go of that line or untied that line, he really could have lost an arm.
Yeah.
And he could have drowned and been sucked under. Like it's really serious, and we take it very seriously, and no one's proud of that moment. It's amazing we captured it, and it's amazing that Ashton came out alive and well, and he's never going to forget that, and we're never going to forget it. But you know, those are the types of things that you get when you're really documenting a true experience, like a true authentic workplace experience. I have no idea how I got to this point in the conversation. What was the question?
How you discovered Captain Lee.
Okay, so Captain Lee.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So when we cast the show, again, we didn't know any of this stuff. Like, I didn't know the bow from the stern, from a halyard line to a tender, to stuff that is just common knowledge now in the Below Deck vernacular. And we're casting a TV show, and of course we're network producers, and you know, oh, who's good looking, and oh, are they fun, or who's going to hook up, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, we try to cast a specific way, thinking like, yeah, this is, it's a sexy job. It's young, good looking people. They're sort of gypsies. They wander the world. They don't have any homes. They kind of just go from boat to boat. And it's just a really crazy sort of lifestyle. And we're going to try and capture it. And when we got there, we found out that the who we'd wanted to captain the boat just did not have the qualifications at all. These are $20 million boats. You have to have a tremendous certifications and licenses to operate them. And one, if you screw up once, again, this is just back to the authenticity. One screw up, you hit the dock. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage. There's just, it's a lot of risk. And it's hard enough for us to convince yacht charters to charter brokers to let us use their boats. You know, like imagine trying to do that in a season one. Hey, we're going to go shoot a reality show on your $20 million yacht. You know, just making that happen was pretty nuts. But the yacht arrived. And when we realized that we didn't have the right qualifications for the captain, we just, all signs were like, well, why don't we go with the captain that just showed up who delivered the yacht? And it was Captain Lee. Like he was the guy that actually worked on the yacht originally. And he, you know, he came with it and delivered it to us. And he was in charge of it, making sure that we were following the rules and you know, taking care of this amazing piece of property, not damaging it and ruining the name of the boat. That was his whole point of being there. And he just was like, the charisma was oozing from him, and he just had to be our captain. And even when we were filming, we didn't really know like how special this like salty sailor was going to be for us. But he started dropping his Captain Lee-isms and his one-liners, and he was like whipping the crew into shape, and the commanding presence he had, it just was like, you couldn't mistake it for anything else. Like it was the stud of the sea. He was there, and it just had worked out amazingly well that he happened to be the original captain of that yacht that was there to sort of make sure we don't screw everything up.
Yeah. I love that. You know, it makes me wonder though, like even in my limited experience with our amazing Bravo celebrities, you know, I am fascinated by the way that someone changes season over season, you know, who they are season one. It naturally changes, you know, because so much fame is thrown at them. And I wonder if someone like Captain Lee, do you feel like he's changed over the years?
I mean, it's hard not to, you know, on some level, but Captain Lee is, he was a captain through and through. He never had aspirations to be on TV. You know, it came to him. And I don't think you can sort of take that away. Obviously, he probably gets like such a kick out of it when he walks into a restaurant with Marianne and people want to take pictures with him. And, you know, he gets to go and like, he wrote a book. I don't know if he was ever going to write a book.
Yeah.
He wrote a book, you know, like,
yeah.
There's some of that. And absolutely, he should. People love him. And for great reason. When I interact with Captain Lee and I get to, you know, download with him or get a sense of the season from him, I mean, it is the same. He's the same man that, you know, I met and have been working with for years. And, I'm actually not working on the original Below Deck anymore, but I know that he's in good hands with the other executives, Pamela Jimenez, who's overseeing that show. But from all I hear and, you know, the way I keep up with Captain Lee, he's still the same old Captain Lee, and he'll drop a Lee-ism on you like it's nothing.
Yeah. Well, and what you do work on right now is Below Deck Sailing Yacht, right?
That's right.
And we are about to see the season premiere of that, which I'm so excited for everyone else to see. I've obviously gotten a sneak peek, but what are you excited for this season?
I honestly cannot even tell you that it is going to, you know, for those who were, you know, who sampled and checked it out season one, it is just one of the greatest things about being a TV executive. If you are so lucky to get a season two, and it is so hard to have a TV show breakthrough and to get a season two, is that you learn a lot from season one and you get to apply it on season two. And if all things go as planned, it is just bigger and badder and better and sexier and funner and like all of those like very lame adjectives I just told you. But it is just season two, the cast delivers. And again, it's everything you love about Below Deck. These are like true yachties. I think that if there's ever been a silver lining about the pandemic, is that these yachties were ready to work and ready to party and ready to be around people their own age in person and have a cocktail in the hot tub. And it is just wonderful to watch them get that chance to be out of quarantine.
We can expect at least one cast hookup.
I don't know if I will ever, if I would ever go into that hot tub after this.
That says it all. You know, we're talking about all the shows that you work on. What is one show that you have just admired from afar at Bravo that you're like, oh, I would love to get my hands on that show?
So the way that the projects work, for us is, you know, once a producer or internally there's a great idea for a show, we work with producers to kind of visualize the show, bring it together in like a presentation. And then usually the executive team comes together and everyone sort of weighs in and all the way up the chain and all the different departments from, you know, legal and business affairs to press and marketing, you know, what are the, you know, out of the 20 or so projects that we've worked on in the past, you know, quarter, how many of these, you know, what are the two or three that everybody really, really loves and thinks we should like give a crack at? And I remember that there was a presentation for a show called Southern Charm that was a little different than the Southern Charm that I think that people have seen, and I think in a good way. But when that presentation came out, and it was just a bunch of just, you know, young guys whooping it up in Charleston with no responsibilities, and it just felt like so funny, and it was like Animal House, and, you know, luckily times have changed a little bit, and maybe we've evolved as a species over the past 10 years. You know, I think that that series was something that I would have loved to have, you know, gotten my hands on. But I do think that thankfully, you know, an executive, Kathleen French, who's so brilliant, made sure that there was strong female voices in that show that did not exist whatsoever in the presentation. And I think has really helped define that show and made it as amazing as it is.
You know, when I was learning about all the Bravo shows that you've worked on, one of the ones that I was fascinated by was The Candy Factory. What was that like?
God, you know, somehow we thought, well, let's take on American Idol. No, I'm just kidding. So here's the thing with the Candy Factory was, again, just an unbelievable, amazing talent on our air with Candy Burris, who besides being just talented as a, you know, a docu-soap legend and the Real House, a Real Housewife, she actually comes from like this unbelievably successful, you know, music career. And she just, you know, she's a fantastic performer and singer. And, you know, we had been thinking about, you know, spinning off some of our biggest names on Bravo and like, what are some vehicles for them and what are they passionate about? So how can we really sort of tap into what's special about them? And, you know, I had never worked on The Real Housewives, but I knew Candy, of course, just being a fan of the franchise. And I had an opportunity to work closely with her. And she really believed in this notion of making over people that had this dream, this fantasy of being a pop star. And you know, people from all walks of life, you know, like amazing stories. And, you know, people that would never get the opportunity to be in front of the camera or to have a one-on-one with Candy and work with Candy's producing team and be able to, you know, show off that their talents in a very raw form that needed to be made over and finessed and groomed. And it was just a really fun sort of transformational makeover show that, you know, wasn't as successful as we had hoped, but it was all in an effort of sort of taking advantage of the amazingness of Candy Burris.
Well, and Something Great did come out of that show, right?
Something Great did come out of that show. As if I recall correctly, you know, the Candy found her soulmate. Lo and behold, on the Candy Factory, who was a producer on the show, Todd, I think they met behind the scenes on that series, actually. And that was kind of a cool thing that happened for them. You know, you don't see that often. We call that a showmance.
Okay, so I want to go back to season one. What was it like bringing Adam on after he was on Below Deck Med? What sort of went into that decision?
You know, there's a couple reasons that we did that. I think first and foremost, you know, Adam is unbelievably talented with, you know, in his culinary skills. Like he brings a very specific approach that we thought could really lend itself to sailing. He's worked on sailboats, so obviously he has the experience. And there was just a rustic nature, a more outdoorsy vibe, a more down-to-earth kind of approach to the entire series that we thought that Adam's skill set and his approach to cooking could really thrive. I think you saw that in the show. I don't think that there's any question that Adam cooked his face off in that series. There may be other question marks about Adam in season one, but the cooking, no question. I think he held his own quite well. You know, when you're launching a new franchise also of Below Deck, you know, we found some really great success and it always just makes sense. So none of these decisions are forced. Some of it just is very rational and logical and just makes sense. Like when we hired Chef Ben to be a part of the first season in Below Deck Med, again, it just made really perfect sense. He had the skill set and the resume, and obviously he was just so well received by the audience of just being just a fantastic Below Deck character. Just made perfect sense. And we had a similar approach with Adam. You know, we thought it would be a great entry point for new viewers who are fans of Adam, who have seen him evolve over a couple seasons in the Med. Both of those seasons, he had very different, you know, he had very different times on the show. And I'm sure fans were very curious to see, okay, well, what is this version of Adam? And this is so much more in his wheelhouse. So that was a lot of the thinking there with Adam, along with his resume and his background.
So were you surprised at all by the Adam and Jenna romance that blossomed in season one? Or did you sort of have an inkling early on that maybe that would happen?
Nobody would have ever guessed that they were going to connect the way they did. And honestly, as it was happening in real time, I just think that we all were sort of dumbstruck by it. We absolutely try to bring on people that we think will have a chemistry, good, bad, you know, all of the different feels that you can get in a season of Below Deck. And that's the fun of it. But again, none of it's forced. These are all people that work in this field, and it is just it's a very gypsy lifestyle. A lot of people that are yachties, they don't really have a home. They just bounce from boat to boat. They see the world. They get amazing experiences. But they are, you know, they're single. They're living their best life season after season and getting to just constantly work with, like, fun people their age. And there is. There's a lot of fraternizing. There's a lot of hooking up. And these people, it's just kind of par for the course in this world. There's not a ton of effort in putting single people on the boat together. And as you can see in season one, we had an established couple, which was kind of a new thing for us that we wanted to explore. But when we brought Jenna and Adam and the rest of the cast members on the yacht, we anticipate certain people might connect more than others. That was not the case with Adam and Jenna.
Right. How would you say the season two cast compares with the season one cast?
I would say that this season two cast, for many, many different reasons, is bringing such a fresh new energy to the franchise. You know, we followed that story of having an existing couple and what's the ebb and flow of living and working with someone that you're in an established relationship with while surrounded by a bunch of single people. On this season, again, we sort of went back to the tried and true. Everyone was single. And I think that you will find that we have the most diverse cast in the history of Below Deck, bringing all sorts of new backstories that we're excited about. And we started filming in the height of the pandemic. You know, there's a lot of these people have either been in quarantine because of just the state of the world. Their jobs had been, you know, sort of ripped away from them. You know, not a lot of people are taking vacations, at least not luxury vacations, on mega yachts, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic. And there was just not a lot of work for them. And I think that we sort of caught lightning in a bottle on this. There were fantastic casts, incredibly experienced, and they had not probably spent time with another human being like this in many, many months. And just, it was like a powder keg. The energy that comes from them and their interactions and all of that just pent up sexual energy is going to be on full display.
I mean, yes, episode two, Gary comes in hot during that charter, the first crew hangout after their first charter. That was amazing. Do you think him and Sydney's hookup was like the quickest hookup in Below Deck history?
I'm sure there are many regrets from Gary and Sydney after that first hookup. You know, they're in the same department. It's their first week. You know, again, I think there was a lot of pent up energy that was expressed in a very fun, you know, exciting, sexy way in that after that first charter. You know, they worked their butts off. They probably hadn't been around young, single, sexy people like this in quite some time. And I think that it was just bound to happen.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see how this plays out for the rest of the season.
As you should be.
One of the things that I love about this show as compared to our other ones is, you know, like on a Real Housewives or a Vanderpump or a Southern Charm, I mean, these people go back to their own homes at the end of the day. There is some separation. And with Below Deck, I mean, that's such close quarters. Do you think that that intensifies the drama and the pent-up sexual tension? Do you think close quarters make such a difference in a show like this?
Below Deck, for a lot of reasons, has just proved itself to be just the perfect backdrop for an unscripted show. None of this is forced. They are living and working together like sardines in a can, and the amount of pressure that is on them to impress their guests, the job just never ends. Their shifts are around the clock. They are exhausted. They work so hard, and when they get a night off, they party twice as hard. It is just so built up. And this is really true to this lifestyle. And I think that, again, you know, having them, there are lots of amazing, we call them house shows, you know, unscripted house shows, from, you know, Big Brother to The Real World. You know, you've seen them all. And if you think about those shows, you know, this is a cast of, you know, those are cast of, you know, young, sexy people, and they're stirring up drama. Now, if you sort of take those mansions and you shrink them down to like a tenth of the size, everything is just amplified. But we're actually tracking a real job and a real lifestyle. There's nothing manufactured about it. And this is how they live. And the people that participate in it are just, they're attracted to it for whatever reason. They live this lifestyle, and it's just, they just thrive in it. And again, it's like lightning in a bottle being on one of those boats.
When you guys decided to move forward with Jean-Luc, did you have any idea that his size would become a factor in terms of like, he can't even fit into his bunk?
When we were introduced to Jean-Luc, there were lots of questions raised about how he would fit. But look, this is a guy who's done this job. He has slept on boats. He's made it work. You know, it feels stunty on some level, but it really wasn't. This is totally real. He is a 6'9" yachty, and you see him standing next to Captain Glenn, and it's just perfection.
I love that in the second episode, we know he can't sleep, but he literally will take exhaustion over sleeping in the same bunk with Captain Glenn, his boss. Do you feel like Captain Lee would ever share a bunk with a crew member?
Well, first you have to put yourself in Jean-Luc's shoes. He's somewhat green to the industry. Again, he's done this before, but he's still new. He's still new. And, you know, it's intimidating if you think about sharing a bunk with your boss.
Absolutely. Also an HR nightmare for most industries.
Yes, that is, there's not a lot of HR on these boats. But, you know, he's working hard and partying hard like the rest of them. He doesn't really want to have to stumble back to his bunk after a nice night of cocktails in the jacuzzi and risk waking up your boss. It's a really funny situation that we love, that is, again, authentic to this world. You know, you see Captain Lee or Captain Sandy, I mean, they get to, on some level, be above it all. They have these amazing captain's quarters, and they don't necessarily even know what's going on below deck. For a lot of the season, a lot of that's revealed to them when they're watching the episodes. But Captain Glenn, he is there. I mean, he's living in it. There's nothing that he doesn't hear. And it's just so funny to me that he is who he is, and he's been doing this job a real long time, and nothing phases him. And, you know, he's seen it all. So it's whatever we could throw at Glenn, it just doesn't phase the man, and which is just, it never ceases to amaze me, his demeanor through all of it.
No kidding. I mean, he seems like the nicest, most chill guy. But I do know in the super tease for this season, which, you know, all the fans study meticulously, we see him lose his cool. Are we going to get a little bit of a different side to him this season?
I I related to, you know, the type of parents that don't get mad. They just get sort of, they get disappointed. And it just hurts that much more. And when they blow up, you know, it's serious. So yeah, brace yourself for the wrath of Captain Glenn. It does not happen often, but you're going to see a side of it, and it is earned.
What can you tell us about any of the relationships for this season, platonic or not? Anything that you can sort of tease us?
Well, you met Gary in episode one.
Sure did.
And you met Daisy.
Yeah.
And you met Natasha. You know, the relationship between the chief stew and the chef is so critical. And we've seen it countless times on the Below Decks, whether it's Kate and Ben, Hannah and Adam. I mean, it just goes on and on through the, you know, the history of Below Deck. And those two positions together are so responsible for the guest experience. And of course, you know, the deckhands and the exterior team, you know, they're kind of like the fun crew setting up the activities and doing, you know, the adventure stuff and the water sports. But in a lot of ways, it really comes down to the chief stew and the chef. And when they are not in symphony with each other, it is a massive hurdle to overcome. And we will be exploring that relationship fully on this season. And the part of it, you know, all of these cast members, again, bring a wealth of experience to the boat. And they all have very specific ways of doing stuff. There is never, what's really interesting about this industry is that there's such a revolving door on these boats, and you just sort of drift from job to job, that it's very rare that you as a yacht crew, season over season, are working together and creating a vibe and creating a workflow and a system. You really have this one charter season to figure it out. And honestly, by the time all of the wrinkles are ironed out, you're on to your next job. It's not like you're on a team together for many years and really understand each other and start to anticipate each other and have like a really great working relationship. It's just such an interesting dynamic. And you will absolutely see that on this season as they are trying to navigate each other. You saw Gary and Sydney. They have a very interesting first charter with each other. You will get to see how long the interests in each other lasts and if there's other people that are going to come into that equation. Gary has a wandering eye, and that is going to come to play. You know, there's a very, very unexpected romance that you're going to see between two cast members that I cannot wait for that to start coming out in the cuts. And, you know, the cabin bunking situation with Jean-Luc, that's going to play out in very interesting ways as well. It'll have a great effect on the season.
Wow. I'm excited.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It was really so nice to learn about all of this stuff. And I mean, I think that, you know, it's a rare view into the world of Bravo. And I know that I speak for the fans when I say thank you for enlightening us.
Of course, this is fun to chat with you guys and sort of look back through the years of all of the craziness, but it's been a lot of great TV and a lot of fun projects, and thanks for putting this together.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 9. And remember, watching Bravo isn't a guilty pleasure.
It's self-care.
Guys, let's keep the conversation going. We want to talk to you all week long, not just Thursdays. You can find us on Instagram at Bravo Daily Dish.
And on Twitter at Bravo TV. Just don't forget to use the hashtag Bravo Daily Dish.
Or reach out to us personally. I'm everywhere at Meg Segura.
And I'm everywhere at Eric J. Mack. That's E-R-I-K.
And if you're on Facebook, join the Daily Dish Facebook group.
You can post about what you're watching, your favorite shows, who's your favorite housewife, ask a question, start some drama. There's a lot of good stuff in there, so check it out.
You can also learn more about the podcast at bravotv.com.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Looking fine, and I got my girls with me. With the boys at the table getting tipsy, miss me, kiss me.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuge,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat!
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.